You've got mail.
Everybody gets a piece, we're going mainstream. Everybody's gonna eat, we're going mainstream. All my family is sick. See you on Main Street, we're going mainstream.
From Wall Street to Melrose Avenue,
we're going mainstream.
Venture capitalists to athletes to
we're
creators.
Welcome back to the All Goes Mainstream podcast. Today's episode with an internet legend provides an illuminating window into how the past can help inform us about the future. Steve Case is a pioneer and a visionary. He built one of the foundational companies of the internet, AOL, that brought America and the world online. As one of America's best known and most accomplished entrepreneurs, Steve has spent the past 39 years building, investing in, and shaping business policy for many foundational companies. His entrepreneurial career began in 1985 when he co-founded America Online. Under Steve's leadership, AOL became the world's largest and most valuable internet company. AOL was the first internet company to go public and one of the best performing stocks of the 1990s, delivering 11,616% return to shareholders. At its peak, nearly half of the internet users in the US used AOL. Steve then built another successful company, Revolution, a Washington, D.C.-based investment firm that backs entrepreneurs at every stage of their development. Revolution Growth has invested nearly $1 billion in growth stage companies, including Sweetgreen, Tempus, Tela, DraftKings, and Clear. Revolution Ventures has invested in almost 30 companies, including Framebridge and SRS Aquium. Revolution's Rise the Rest seed fund has invested in over 200 startups across 100 U.S. cities, building critical ecosystem development for entrepreneurship across the country. Steve's passion for helping entrepreneurs has extended to the policy world. He was the founding chair of the Startup America Partnership, an effort launched at the White House in 2011 to accelerate high-growth entrepreneurship around the country. He was also the founding co-chair of the National Advisory Council on Innovation and Entrepreneurship and a member of President Obama's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, which he chaired the Subcommittee on Entrepreneurship. He was also instrumental in passing the Jobs, Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act and the Investing in Opportunities Act. He's also the chairman of the Case Foundation, which he established with his wife, Jean, in 1997, and together in 2010, they joined the Giving Pledge. Steve is also the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Third Wave, An Entrepreneur's Vision of the Future and the Rise of the Rest, How Entrepreneurs in Surprising Places Are Building the American Dream, which has ended up serving as a fantastic blueprint for the next wave of the internet. Steve and I had a fascinating and illuminating conversation full of lessons learned from building the first wave of the internet that can be applied to building and investing in companies today. We discussed a number of things, including how Steve and his team built AOL into the world's largest and most valuable internet company at a time when 3% of people were using the internet for 1 hour a day, how revolutions happen in evolutionary ways, the three waves of the internet, and why Steve believes that the third wave is much more complex and will require the ability to navigate policy and partnerships, lessons he learned as a founder to build a successful and diversified investment firm in Revolution, how emerging technology ecosystems can build thriving startup communities starting with tentpole companies, and how the things that happen to you shape how you live your life. Thanks, Steve, for coming on the All Goes Mainstream podcast to share your wisdom, lessons learned, and visionary views of the future. It was an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show.
We're going mainstream.
Steve, welcome to the All Goes Mainstream podcast. Pleasure to have you.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Likewise. There's so much to discuss, particularly because you've seen the multiple waves of the internet that has happened over the last 30 or so years. I'd love to start with how your background as an entrepreneur has informed your views as an investor today. And let's start with the beginning. Tell us how and why you started AOL.
We started in 1985. I was one of three co-founders. And back then, only about 3% of people were using the internet. And those 3% were using it about 1 hour a week. So it's pretty early days in terms of the adoption of the internet. But we believed, obviously, it proved to be the case that eventually the world would get connected, be a new platform for content and community and commerce and so forth. And we wanted to be part of building that medium and figuring out a way to make it easy to use and useful and fun and affordable. So it wasn't just for the tech elites. It really was for everybody. And that was really the focus from day one at AOL.
I think as we've seen these different waves of the internet be built on top of each other, there's always been something that is less obvious at the start, but then becomes obvious over time. You mentioned that there were very few people using the internet when you started AOL. What was it that you saw that others didn't see at the time?
I think, first of all, I should give some credit to Alvin Toffler, the futurist. When I was in college in the late 70s, 79, 80, I read a book he wrote called The Third Wave that basically was predicting this digital future, predicting kind of an electronic cottage, electronic frontier. And his first wave was the Agricultural Revolution. That was followed by the Industrial Revolution. He was predicting, this is over four decades ago, the next big revolution would be the technology revolution. I read that and said that he's totally right. And I want to be part of making that happen. But when I graduated from college in 1980, there were no internet companies to go to, and there were no venture capitalists backing 21-year-old kids with crazy ideas. So I worked for some big companies for a few years, Procter & Gamble in Ohio, and then PepsiCo, the division they had, Pizza Hut in Kansas. But the whole time, I was really more fascinated with what was emerging around the fringes with interactive TV and video text and online services and all kinds of bulletin board services that were happening. And so finally, in 1983, moved to the Washington, D.C. area to join a startup that was focused on this, which then failed a few months after I joined. It kind of crashed. And so that was kind of a little bit of a welcome to the NFL moment around startups, and some work, some don't work. But thankfully, two of the people that were at that company, and I, Jim Kimsey and Mark Sarah, decided to start, you know, well, as I mentioned, in 1985. What we saw was that even though at the time it was too hard to use, you had to figure out how to plug a modem into your computer and figure out how to use communication software, and it was too expensive to use. A lot of the networks were $10 an hour to be connected, which is part of the reason people didn't use it much. And while there wasn't much to do, it was still early days. So media companies hadn't really done content for the internet. New companies hadn't emerged. There was no commerce. There was no people, so there really was no sense of community. So it was kind of early, but there was still something to the idea that eventually this would change the world, and eventually you could build a significant company. And from an investor standpoint, it was hard for us because we were based in the Northern Virginia, the Washington, D.C. area, which there was no venture capital back then, 40 years ago. And we were only able to raise $1 million to launch the company. And one of our competitors, Prodigy, which was backed by IBM and Sears, had committed $1 billion to launch Prodigy. We knew it wasn't going to be a fair fight if we tried to just compete head to head. So that's when we started focusing on strategic partnerships that really could accelerate our growth. And that ended up being a pivotal part of what made AOL successful.
Two questions there. One related to strategic partnerships, but I think to get there, you kind of have to understand, what did you lean on, given that there were really no reference points for starting an internet company when you did? Was there anything that you fell back on as, okay, this is the way we can think about building this, or this is a framework for building both technology business, but also a community business at the time?
What was comforting, kind of a little bit of the almost light at the end of the tunnel, is most of the things that we were envisioning happening in a digital world were already happening in more of an analog world. People were demonstrating they liked to communicate with each other, and they were doing it through making phone calls or writing letters or greeting cards or all kinds of ways to connect with people. So the idea that this would be a better way to just create and distribute content was also pretty obvious, that there are different ways to, beyond traditional newspapers, magazine, television, that the desire to consume the content was clear. The ability to consume it digitally was not yet possible. And also, we, on the commerce side, we believe that even though in the early days it was hard to get people to even type in their credit card because it seemed scary, the internet was maybe some hacker's going to steal your credit card. Eventually, the idea of people being able to buy things online struck us as sort of inevitable. So that, I think, helped guide us. It was harder than we thought, took longer than we thought. It was not at all a overnight success. It really took us about 10 years before we finally broke through. And there were many moments where we had to go through layoffs and look like the company was going to hit the wall. But I think it was helpful to see that light at the end of the tunnel, that sense of what might happen. I wasn't necessarily sure that we would survive to get to the promised land, but I knew that eventually the internet was going to be something that was powerful and pervasive.
Well, one thing that jumped out in what you were talking about earlier was your competitor raised $1 billion. You raised $1 million. You had to think about things differently, certainly adopt a more lean startup approach in a sense, but also you mentioned partnerships and having these strategic partnerships was key. Walk us through that thought process of how you did that and why you did it.
Well, we did it mostly because we had to. It goes back to this issue of being scrappy and having to be capital efficient. We thought we could build a compelling service, but we didn't think we could on our own successfully market and successfully commercialize that service. The first partners were the computer manufacturers, particularly the people focused on home computers. Back then in the mid 80s, the number one home computer was the Commodore 64. So we went to Commodore and said, we want to do a service for you. We'll create a custom online service for Commodore 64 owners. We'll do all the work in building it. We want you to take the lead in marketing it and bundle it with your computers and your modems and so forth. Then we did a similar deal with Radio Shack. Tandy at the time had a big computer division. Then we did a deal with IBM when they were launching a consumer PC. Then we did a deal with Apple to create something called Apple Inc. Personal Edition. So for the first 5 years, we kind of were in the business of creating these custom white label services in partnership with the PC manufacturers. We take the lead in building and running it. They take the lead in promoting it and marketing it. And that worked pretty well. That got us going. And then we were able to start raising additional capital. And in 1992, we went public, first internet company to go public. We raised $10 million in our IPO, and it was worth $70 million that day. But thankfully, we then got some real traction and momentum. And by the end of the decade, it had gone from $70 million to $160 billion, which is when we did the merger with Time Warner. But those early days, we had to be scrappy. Partnerships were critical, particularly on the marketing side. But then we expanded that with partnerships on the content side to deals with a lot of media companies. We also did it on the communication side, including partnering with your father, John Sidgemore, who ran UUNET, one of the innovative companies there in terms of building out networks. We knew we had to get the cost of access down. We knew we couldn't rely on just the traditional phone companies to do that. So we had to establish partnerships and make some acquisitions to basically accelerate the growth of low-cost networks so more people could connect and they could connect at affordable prices. I don't know if everybody knows, probably most of your listeners don't know this story, but your father, who sadly passed away 2 decades ago, was one of the real pioneers in the internet. And the internet wouldn't be what it is today without people like your father, John. And he was a great friend as well as a great partner.
Well, really appreciate that. And it took a community to make that happen, of course. And I think that's such an interesting and integral piece of what you built at AOL was you built the infrastructure and you built the technology, but you also built the community. With the community, you built the content. And if you roll things forward to today, you think about some of the companies you've invested in at Revolution. Many of them are great consumer businesses where they've built either community or content in some way, shape, or form. I'd love to hear how you thought about building both content and community at AOL, the core tenets of that, and then how you've thought about that as the internet's evolved into these kind of three waves, as you discussed in your book, which we'll also get to, as you think about kind of content and community today.
Well, when we first launched our first service, which was in the fall of 1985, it was very focused on community. And some of that was because we always believed, and it's proven to be the case, that the killer app of the internet was people interacting with each other, both people they already knew and different ways to stay connected, as well as people they didn't know but should know because they had some shared interest. We always believed that would be key. And AOL, when I was running it, more than half of all our traffic were community-related features. So we knew that was super important. It also is pretty pragmatic. It goes back to the point around being scrappy. We needed partners to help market by focusing on community. We didn't have a budget to create content. We didn't have a budget to license content. That was the easy way to enter the market. And then once we had loyal members who were part of the AOL community, they helped launch some of the content initially with things like bulletin boards and other things. And over time, that kind of expanded. And then we were able to start licensing content. It became more compelling. We were able to attract more members because we had more members, we had more buying power, and it got that increasing returns network effect kind of cycle going. So it was like many companies, you had to start somewhere, a little bit of a lily pad strategy. You go from one to the next to the next, and you just try to keep moving forward. And then you look for opportunities for the breakout moments, the transformation moments where you really could dramatically accelerate what was possible. And as I said, that for us was about a decade into it when It went from nobody knows or cares about the internet to suddenly everybody wanted to be connected. And thankfully, at that time, we were in the right place at the right time. And most of Americans did go on AOL for their first experience on to connect to the internet, because we had established a brand. We had a lot of people online. We had a service that was easier to use in terms of the software, the graphical interface. We had a service that was less expensive because we had done deals with your father and others on the network infrastructure side. We then had more compelling content. We had different community with the chat rooms and buddy lists and instant messaging and things like that we recreated. So that's when things really started taking off. But one of the lessons that I think about, to your question about how we think about investing at Revolution and backing entrepreneurs, is going for these big ideas. It might take some time. And recognizing that the biggest, boldest ideas almost certainly will take some time. And maybe you get lucky, Mark Zuckerberg sitting in his little dorm at Harvard coming up with the idea of Facebook. That kind of was an overnight success, but that's more rare. I think what's more common is a situation where you have to take the long view. And I learned from that and some of the other companies we backed that sometimes revolutions happen in more evolutionary ways, and you've got to take the long view.
It's such a great point. I think brings up such an interesting question, particularly when it comes to consumer, where being at the right time in the right place is so important. When you think about investing in consumer-oriented companies today, how much do you think of it about this is the right time for this product or the right place for this product? And how do you go about evaluating that?
At Revolution, we have several groups. We have the really early stage Rise of the Rest seed fund that's investing in different parts of the country. We have Revolution Ventures, which is more of a classic Series A investor. And we have our later stage Revolution Growth Fund. And we also have some real estate activities related to Rise of the Rest and some other things. So the answer to the question depends on which stage you're at. Are you really just getting going? Does it have a little bit of traction? Are you really trying to scale it? In the case of Revolution Growth, the later stage one, which is probably the companies more people are familiar with, we back companies like Clear, the biometric company, now in a lot of airports and increasingly also in sporting arenas. Back DraftKings, which has been very successful now, also a public company, started with fantasy sports, then moved into gaming. We backed Scopely, which just got acquired last year, about $5 billion in the mobile gaming space. Sport Radar, another sports tech company that's been quite successful around analytics. And then some consumer companies, including even in the restaurant sector, companies like Cava and Sweetgreen that are now both public companies. And the way we analyze each and try to underwrote each is a little bit different. But in the case of something like Cava and Sweetgreen, we believe that the restaurant business was going to get disrupted, that one sector of the restaurant business, fast food, would lose ground to fast casual, and that fast casual that had a focus on healthier menus would ultimately prevail. And the companies that really were building new brands for a new generation, almost the next generation, McDonald's or Chipotle, if you will, and use technology, both in terms of connecting to consumers as well as connecting to farmers and sort of a farm-to-table supply chain kind of thing, would be the victors. We made those investments almost a decade ago when they were pretty small companies. Now, Cava's has a $7 billion market cap. I think Sweetgreen is $2 to $2.5 billion, something like that. And they've both proven that they can break out and scale. And they have built strong consumer brands. They do have a connection to their customers. Most people order on their phones, for example. And they've done a great job executing against that. But there basically was the thesis that the sector was going to change, that new brands would be part of that, but also leveraging technology would be part of that.
You mentioned these offline brands are able to leverage technology to connect with their customers better. How do you think the best companies, particularly in spaces like food, Cava, Sweetgreen, how do they manage that interplay between offline and online and create kind of the benefits of leverage from technology while also still remaining an offline business?
Yeah, it's really tricky. And obviously, something, particularly the restaurant business, is a really tough execution business, really tough operations intensive. There's only so much you can do with the technology, only so much you can do with the branding side. Every day, you have to have people in the restaurants making the food and have an experience that really is magical and leads people to become very loyal customers. But that ties in with a broader theme that we have at Revolution. I think we're starting to see more and more of this in the market, where we've kind of shifted from software-centric businesses to much more integrated businesses where there's sometimes software, there's sometimes hardware, there's sometimes services, there's sometimes an offline component. And that's what makes things really interesting. It's when you can integrate across the value chain, including things you do yourself, but often things you do in partnership with others. That's really where I think the puck is going, and some of the big businesses of tomorrow will be built. One example of that is we backed a company in Chicago called Tempus that used AI, machine learning, to focus on cancer and other things. And they've done a really successful job because they didn't just build technology that was compelling, but they partnered with the major hospitals initially focused on cancer research and been able to aggregate that data. And as a result, have created a model where somebody diagnosed with a disease now can go to Tempus and have a much more precise understanding what they're dealing with, and therefore a much more personalized approach in terms of what's possible. The technology was super compelling, but it was the partnerships they formed, and that's what you're seeing now across healthcare. It's how do you make sure you get doctors and nurses to use it, and hospitals to integrate it, and health plans to pay for it, and regulators to allow it. That's critically important. The other one I mentioned, Clear, using their biometric technology, that also is compelling technology, but they really added value, and the company really accelerated in terms of its value creation when they established partnerships with airports and got the transportation authorities to allow them to be in the airports. Then they were able to build a network of airports that became a compelling proposition to travelers. They can get through security faster and get to their plane faster. But it wasn't the biometric technology that just was the table stakes. It was the partnerships they then formed that really enabled that to become a significant consumer business.
Those are two great examples of how technology can be a leverage point to then helping either the partners or the end consumers. But I think you're hitting on something which is a fascinating concept, which is the evolution of the way software businesses are constructed. And I think you even mentioned this in the third wave, the book that you wrote about the third wave, kind of focusing on saying, hey, essential and even hard tech industries, climate, defense tech, healthcare, these core industries are going to reshape and redefine technology. So what do you think that founders and teams need to have in terms of the DNA of their business, the way that they operate, that's different than perhaps technology entrepreneurs of waves one and two?
To frame it a little bit for people's benefit, I mentioned the Toffler book, The Third Wave, that inspired me. So when I wrote a book, I think it was 7 or 8 years ago, that was a little bit my history with the internet, but also some of the experience we had through investments at Revolution, I decided to call it Third Wave. Thankfully, Toffler was still alive at the time, and I could get him a copy of it, and it paid tribute to him as part of the book. That really was a key part of my early experience. The way I framed it for my book, The Third Wave, is the first wave was really getting America online, getting the world online. It goes back to what we said at the very beginning. When we got started, nobody was using it. And it was just a fringy hobbyist kind of computer hacker kind of thing. It took us 20 years in the 80s and 90s, but basically got everybody connected, built that infrastructure. Companies like UUNET and many others that basically built the on-ramps to make the internet possible. That then unleashed the second wave, which has been most of the last couple of decades, which is basically software running on top of the internet, apps running on top of the internet. You didn't have to worry about the internet infrastructure because that was all built. You didn't need more servers. You didn't need modems or other kinds of things that you did in the first wave. So you could launch an app like a Facebook or a Google or so many others riding on top of that infrastructure. The third wave is sort of when the internet meets the real world. And examples I mentioned like healthcare or food or agriculture or many others play into it. And that's where, as I said, with the examples with Tempus and Clear, the technology, of course, is very important. But the partnerships you form to really drive adoption are essential. Understanding the nuances around policy are also essential. So I think this next generation of companies will need to have a more diverse mix of founders and management teams that understand some of those issues, that people aren't just able to build it, but able to get people to trust them and partner with them to really accelerate the growth and also deal with regulators, because these industries are so fundamental in terms of our everyday life, how we stay healthy, what we eat, things like that. They're going to be regulated, not just in this country, but all around the world. So it creates an added challenge. And some of the companies that they're backing understand that and really bring the right mix of skill sets to bear so they can build something, a product, a technology that's compelling, but also figure out a way to break through and commercialize it in a very significant way.
sounds like when you describe the third wave, there are some shades of similarities to the first wave, not as much to the second wave, but to the first wave. How much would you say, certainly in different ways, but those core tenets of you need a partner, need to do things a little bit differently than maybe the second wave of the internet did. How much would you say the third wave is a lot like the first wave in your mind?
Totally like it. That was part of the even the reason I wrote the book. I was asked to write a book many times. It was about the early days of AOL or the lesson learned building the internet or what happened with the Time Warner merger and why that didn't work out. It wasn't that interesting. What inspired me to actually write the book was exactly your point. When I realized that we were coming to the end of the second wave, we're about to start the third wave, and the third wave would look a lot like the first wave. So I could write a book that includes some of the lessons from the past because it actually could help inform the future. And you're exactly right. That in that first wave, and I used some of the examples earlier, companies like AOL would not have been successful without partnerships. We had 300 partners with media companies, communications companies, PC companies, all kinds of companies. And together, we were able to create the stand up the internet and drive the adoption of the internet. Partnerships were really essential. Policy was really essential. When we started AOL, people have a hard time believing this, it was actually still illegal against the law for consumers or businesses to be on the internet. The internet was funded by government, by DARPA, more than a half century ago. And initially, it was only allowed non-commercial use. You could be a government agency, you could use the internet. You could be at a college campus, you could be the internet. But consumers at home or businesses and their offices couldn't use the internet. So we had to change the regulation. We had to get Congress to pass laws to basically open up the internet. And we had to do a lot of things around e-commerce and taxation and keeping kids safe on the internet, a bunch of different things. And policy was really front and center. The internet couldn't have happened without some changes in policy, including, by the way, some judicial decisions. Judge Green broke up the Ma Bell, the phone company, into regional Bell operating companies, which unleashed competition that resulted in costs of connectivity going down dramatically, which made the internet kind of revolution all possible. So the policy aspect was critically important. So those were front and center for the first wave. As you said, they weren't that important for the second wave because you're building on the internet infrastructure. You didn't really need partners. You could just drop your app in the app store and spread virally and ta-da, you're in business. And you also didn't really need to engage, at least when you were small, on the policy front. But the third wave in sectors like healthcare and some of the other ones we talked about, you've got to figure out your partner strategy. You've got to figure out your policy strategy in order to be successful. And we've seen that with some of our companies in our Rise to Rest portfolio in different cities around the country, like one in Atlanta called Hermias. Spun out of Georgia Tech, really interesting technology, kind of Mach 5 technologies you can get from Atlanta to Europe in 90 minutes. And it's a really amazing technology. But what's more amazing is they figured out ways to establish partnerships, including with folks like the Air Force, which signed a $70 million contract with them to provide some of the capital they needed to build the technology. But also, obviously, the Air Force likes to move stuff around pretty fast, and then they become a great customer. So those are examples of the kind of companies we're seeing now. And certainly, we're looking to back at Revolution that have a big idea or trying to create a company that can transform an existing industry, disrupt an existing industry, but bring the lens that partnerships are likely going to be important, maybe essential, and policy is likely going to be important, maybe essential as well.
That example about Hermias, I think, is such a great jumping off point to the next question, which ties into what you said about the third wave and the types of things required to make companies successful. You mentioned policy, you mentioned partnerships, you mentioned diverse mix of founders. Does this, in your mind, change the construct of venture and investment firms in terms of the competencies and skill sets they need to best help entrepreneurs in today's world of the internet?
I think we've seen different waves of the evolution of venture capital. When we were getting started, venture was pretty small. There was only actually a small number of venture firms that really had credibility. If you got them to invest, they didn't just get their capital, but you kind of got their imprimatur. And some of the, for example, Kleiner Perkins was one of the early investors in AOL, as well as Allstate Insurance and Merrill Pickard and a bunch of other firms that were the key venture firms at the time. As it's expanded and really almost exploded, and venture as privates in general, but venture as an asset class in particular, has become much more a core part of portfolios of institutional investors, family offices, and others. You've seen a proliferation of more venture funds, and a lot of them differentiate in different ways. But it started with kind of an edge around access. Maybe you worked at Google and you're starting a firm, and ex-Google people, and you can get into those companies, and that's worked for a lot of folks. Then you also can add add some value in terms of maybe helping them with, you know, they're building up their teams or helping them think through, you know, issues around culture or what have you. But increasingly, I think the value add has shifted to being able to help on the partnership front and help on the policy front. And even here at Revolution, partly because we're based in Washington, D.C., so we have a, you know, maybe more in our DNA, we've built up a policy network and a lot of, you know, relationships with people, including John Delaney, who is a senior advisor here, who started a couple of companies that he took public that was in Congress and actually ran for president, and now, you know, focusing on working with us to invest in the next generation of companies. That would not have been as obvious 10 years from now, but that lens, I think, is increasingly important. And you're starting to see more venture firms recognize that if they really want to be participants in some of these sectors that are getting disrupted. It's more complicated. It does require more patience. You're not going to have sort of that overnight success in some of these areas like healthcare or education or other things. They do require a different kind of a mindset, a different lens in terms of the time horizons. But you also have to bring these other skill sets to bear if you're really going to be a differentiated, you know, venture firm and really add value in a significant, sustainable way.
Do you think that the construct of a venture firm or an asset manager has to change as well to match some of the time horizons and capital that's required in some of these possibly more capital intensive businesses, like you mentioned, healthcare, defense, things like that? Do you think that's going to change as well when you realize what's required, both from a time horizon perspective, as well as a capital requirement perspective to build these businesses?
I think it also leads to a greater degree of specialization, which we're starting to see that if you're just focused, say, on SaaS software kind of companies, that model is fairly predictable. Generally, the capital requirements are reasonably modest. And if you get traction, you can scale it in a reasonably efficient way, as opposed to sectors, say, clean tech, as an example, that, you know, are going to be more capital intensive, which is why 15 years ago, there was a first wave of clean tech venture investing, and it was generally a disappointment. It took more money and took more time than people expected when they were underwriting those investments. Now there's more interest, in part because the size of the opportunity has increased, but also because some of the firms that are focusing on that sector are able to aggregate more capital to really back companies with hundreds of millions of dollars, not just $5, $10, $15, you know, million dollars. And that is changing the game. And the other thing that's changing the game, and I think people haven't focused on this enough, is, you know, the government is now at the table in terms of the role it's playing in driving the innovation economy. And I've seen this firsthand because I've spent some time on these issues over the last decade, including co-chairing the National Advisory Council on Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And we just, you know, put out a report about a month ago. It's called NACI, that was basically a roadmap for a national entrepreneurship strategy so America can continue to lead. And as we're seeing global competition from China and others emerge. And as part of that government effort, you've seen things like Congress passing the CHIPS and Science Act, which funded bringing back semiconductors to America. So we're not relying on Taiwan and other countries for over 90% of our most significant chips. Also funding tech hubs as part of that effort. Inflation Reduction Act is also focused a lot of capital on climate-related technologies. The bipartisan infrastructure bill has created a lot of opportunity. So there's significant funding to the tune of probably $3 trillion over the coming decade that's being injected into the economy to make sure America continues to lead in this next, you know, wave in terms of the innovation economy, does it in a more inclusive way, and particularly wins in some of these different industries. And that access to that capital is also making it much more interesting to focus on some of these sectors, such as climate tech, defense tech, and many others.
You're hitting on something which is really interesting from an allocator LP perspective that I think they need to evolve their thinking on, because traditionally in venture, you could just say, all right, I'm going to invest 10, 15 years from now, companies are going to be built. You don't necessarily need to worry about the macro environment. You don't need to worry about geopolitics, maybe as much as you do today. How do you think about that aspect of things as an investor, really understanding how governments think about technology and the adoption and development of technology, both within their own sovereign state as well as internationally? And then just more broadly, geopolitics as something that's on your mind as an investor?
I think people, some are reluctant to lean into this because it can be frustrating and sometimes kind of just confusing. But I think the reality is, because the technology sector has gone from being a niche thing to essentially being everything. In many respects, every company is a tech company. And because the internet has gone from being this fringy thing we talked about to being this broad-based platform that has impact on really every business, every community, and because it has such a fundamental impact in terms of the basics of our lives, it goes without saying that governments are going to be involved, not just in this country, but around the world. And as we have new technologies, or sort of new technologies, things like AI, it's kind of gotten a lot of traction the last several years because obviously the success of ChatGPT, it's really been developing over the last half century. So it's not really a new technology, but it's new in terms of the speed at which it's being adopted. And now some of the opportunities that are emerging, there's enormous potential for AI. I mentioned what's happening with the company we backed, Tempus. It's saving lives using AI, but there are also tremendous risks associated with AI. And so, of course, it makes sense for governments to be involved. That then requires the innovators to spend more time with the policymakers to educate them about what's happening and what's going to happen next so policymakers can make informed decisions. And that's going to be a core part of this next couple of decades. And the companies need to understand that. The entrepreneurs obviously need to understand that. The investors need to understand that as well. And one way to think about this, going back to the three waves we talked about earlier, in the first wave of the internet, if you're a venture investor, you're largely trying to understand the technology risk. Can you build it? And that was the decision in the 80s and 90s when venture firms were backing companies like AOL. And the second wave, it was pretty clear you could build it. In fact, many people were building comparable things. The question then was, can you market it? Can you commercialize it? Do you have some edge that allows you to be the one that breaks out of the pack and creates the Facebook when there are dozens of other social media firms? So it was really understanding, underwriting around market risk. Now it's increasingly underwriting around partner risk and policy risk. It's not just risk, it's also opportunity. Those some of the right partners, if you don't have them, you might limit your growth and somebody else getting them might take the market. But on the policy side, it's true as well. It's not just navigating policy regulations that might slow you down. It's also how do policies change that might speed you up. I mentioned DraftKings way back when we first invested. We thought it was an interesting opportunity in the fantasy sport, but we also thought there was some possibility the Supreme Court would make a ruling, which they eventually did, that would empower states to decide whether they wanted to allow gaming. That really ended up happening in a way that there was almost an instant 10x increase in the value of companies like DraftKings because of that change in policy. And you think about partners, you think about policy, you can't just think about the risk. You also have to think about the opportunities that can be unlocked if you have the right partners and if you have the right changes in policy.
That's such a great point, and I think ties to how you build a venture firm in today's world, which you've kind of talked about for the last few questions that we've gone over. And I think it's so fascinating to think about the business of asset management and building an investment firm from an entrepreneur's view, because you're an entrepreneur first. You're now building another business, just happens to be an investment firm. So I'd love to take some of what we just discussed and really unpack and understand how you've applied some of those lessons learned from building companies to now building an investment firm, which you're again a founder, just of a different type of company.
When I first stepped down as CEO of AOL, when we announced the merger with Time Warner, which was over 20 years ago, I was 40 years old. I wasn't quite ready to pack it in or go play golf or something. And so I had a phase of, what do I do next? And some of that was philanthropy, but my wife, Jean, was running, still runs the Case Foundation, doing a great job of that. And that didn't really feel like the thing I should focus on, at least not exclusively. And I also was interested in backing the next generation of companies, so started making some investments more out of a family office. And then that evolved to launching our first fund with outside institutional LPs over a decade ago. And that was our growth fund. Then we did a venture fund. Then we did the seed fund. Then we did some things around real estate and also hospitality. So it's evolved over time. And part of that was because I decided if it's set up as a institutional firm with outside investors, but at the same time having strategies that are tightly defined so that you have the benefit of focus, but it's also part of a broader platform and the platform can invest significantly in things like policy and communications and other things that could be really helpful to the, you know, the company we backed. That would be the best way to scale the firm and create opportunities, but both for me, but also for the team here, that would, you know, be more than if it was just more of a family office mentality. So that's how it evolved. There's no particular company I was going to start. Didn't want to spend all my time on philanthropy. I decided I really like backing entrepreneurs. I really like leaning in the future, in some ways living in the future, because that's kind of what venture capitalists have the opportunity to do. I want to do that across multiple sectors, not just do more of the same. I want to do some things that were different. I want to do that with a team that would focus on particular areas and focus on companies at particular stages and work with those companies to try to turn as many of them as possible into big breakout successes.
What lessons do you think you took from building company in AOL to then building Revolution, an investment firm?
I think there's some things that are similar and some things that are different. What's similar is obviously it all comes down to people. The entrepreneurship is a team sport. Investing is a team sport. So getting the right people focused on the right opportunities, working together in the right way is really critical. Also being focused. I think one of the reasons AOL was successful is we really had that tight focus. As I mentioned, some of that was because we had to, because we didn't have much capital. So it forced us to be more efficient, focused, to be more scrappy and so forth. So having a focus on some of the sectors that we're focused on and differentiating with particular focus at Revolution on policy, which we also talked about, and place, not just investing in the usual places like Silicon Valley and New York, or not doing that at least exclusively, making the effort to get around the country, build partnerships around the country, and look for opportunities around the country, we thought was critical. So we make three or four, five sometimes investments out of our growth fund each year. We make three or four or five investments out of our venture fund each year. We typically make 30, 40, 50 investments out of our Rise the Rest seed fund. And we do that in partnership now with 400 regional venture firms. We built an extraordinary network. We see a lot of different things. Our seed fund now has 200 investments in 100 different cities. And that place-based strategy, we thought, would unearth opportunities in places that most people aren't looking at, valuations that are typically lower than if those same companies were located in a place like Silicon Valley. And so it was a little bit of a seeing where the market was going broadly in terms of some of the trends, but also seeing areas that were underserved and saying, let's focus on that. That will help us differentiate it. So now there's a little bit more focus on place, which is good. The pandemic has been an accelerant there. There is a little more focus on policy, but we're trying to make sure we're leading on both in terms of the core positioning at Revolution.
We talked about community before, and effectively what you've done at Rise the Rest is building a community. You had to build communities in all these different ecosystems. And also you've built a community or portfolio of companies that then lead to potentially working with them at ventures and growth. So it's an interesting way to think about community as well.
Well, in some ways, it's a fair point, because so maybe I only have one trick, which is building networks and building community. And 40 years ago, I was focused on building the internet. Now it's focused on building Revolution and building a broader network of venture firms and entrepreneurs all across the country.
Saying you only have one trick is probably being a little too modest. But related to that, though, and I think you were onto this well before others were, this whole Rise of the Rest movement. What was it that you saw that made you say, you know what, we need to help build up all of these different ecosystems around the US? Because one, there's really interesting technology, talent, and companies. And two, to your point about different kinds of companies that need to be built, was there something that you saw that led you to believe that we need to go and execute on this strategy?
Yeah, it was a few things that converged in my mind over a decade ago. And it took me a little while to figure this out, but it started on the policy front. I was working on this at National Advisory Council Innovation Entrepreneurship as the founder of the first one 13, 14 years ago. That led to a series of recommendations. It also led to the White House launching an effort called Startup America, and President Obama asked me to chair that. And that was about regional entrepreneurship. Also led to the Jobs Act, which passed over a decade ago, that, as you know, changed the rules around how entrepreneurs can access capital. And so that really got me going. And the two things that I remember learning about, and maybe I should have known, I didn't know, but number one is that most of the jobs in the country are created by new companies less than 5 years old, startups, not by big companies, not by small business, but by new business. That was interesting to me. And the second was that while not every one of those new businesses wants or even needs venture capital, the ones that are most successful and create the most jobs and create the most value do get venture capital. But 75% of the venture capital was going to three states, California, New York, and Massachusetts. So the other 47 states were disadvantaged. As a result, you saw people growing up in those states or going to school in those states, then leave to go to the coast. So there was sort of a brain drain in those communities. Yet some of the great ideas were being birthed at those universities or national labs around the, you know, country. So there was just a big white space there. And that's really what led us to launch Rise of the Rest as initially as a series of bus tours and then as its own dedicated fund. I mentioned Hermias in Atlanta. We also backed a company called Acre Trader in Arkansas that's built a platform to invest in farmland. We backed Freightwaves in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that's basically focused on the trucking and logistics industry. And many of the most significant trucking companies are headquartered in Chattanooga, so that's a good place to be. StockX, we backed in Detroit. It's kind of created the stock market for things. Prion, a company in North Carolina, the founder actually created the Alexa technology that Amazon acquired. Now he's created a new company. Anduril in Southern California on the defense tech side. These are some of the companies we back that are in places that most venture capitalists 10 years ago wouldn't even look. And we're now seeing these ecosystems develop. More people are staying there now. More people are boomerang back there now. You're starting to see the breakout successes that then create the next generation of companies. And the last point I'll make that I reflect on is a little bit personal. I grew up in Hawaii, which because it's the 50th state and it's kind of a series of islands, is sort of disconnected from the rest of the country and sometimes feels a little bit left out. And as we discussed earlier, it started AOL in Northern Virginia, and we started here 40 years ago. It was not a startup town. There was no venture capital here. And it was hard to get going. It was hard to get started. And so I think I feel a certain empathy for the entrepreneurs who are building companies in Columbus or Detroit or Minneapolis or Phoenix or Denver or many of the other cities, as well as seeing the policy imperative that we need to level the playing field, make sure everybody everywhere has a shot at creating companies, a shot at creating jobs, as well as an investment strategy, which is, as you know, the way to make money in investments is to do something a little bit different than the pack. And so focusing on places that most people weren't focusing on and finding great entrepreneurs there has been a core part of our strategy.
How do you know when that right inflection point is to start investing in ecosystems or areas that may be underinvested in or underdeveloped, but then they're right on that inflection point?
Well, there's not surprisingly a tiering to them. We've now invested, as I said, in 100 different cities, but some are more fully developed ecosystems that are already seeing an acceleration. Austin, Seattle are some of the ones that come to mind. And there's a lot that are still in the emerging factor. There's certainly some cities where we have a handful of investments, other cities where we just have one. But what happens is once you have a tentpole company success, suddenly a lot of good things happen. And we were one of the tentpole companies, as well as your father's company, UUNET, in Northern Virginia, in Indianapolis. It's really accelerated in the last decade because the tentpole company there was ExactTarget that got acquired by Salesforce for several $1 billion. Now there's dozens of companies, mostly in the enterprise software space, that have spun out. Salesforce now actually has 2,000 employees in Indianapolis, the second largest headquarters for them after San Francisco itself. And that's because of the success of one of those companies. So looking for companies to back and then looking to see a cluster of companies in a particular sector is a good lens to look at. But now you also have to add, as I mentioned, this lens of recognizing what the government doing in terms of tech hubs, the investment of the Chips and Science Act in Columbus, for example. Intel is now building a very significant presence in the Columbus area, and you're seeing an acceleration of venture capital and new companies being launched in Columbus. That's also happening in dozens of other cities. So what used to be a kind of a rare phenomenon is now becoming much more of a common phenomenon. And I think 10 years from now, investors look at their portfolios, they'll be much more regionally distributed, which is not to say that Silicon Valley won't still lead by far. It will lead, but it's not going to have the dominance in the future that it has right now. The innovation economy is going to be dispersed both around the world and around the country. I think that's good for the country.
I want to, on that point, go back to go forward, because there's so many interesting emerging categories, whether they may be more hard tech related, maybe AI, climate, clean energy, even crypto to some extent. What would you say are some of the things that remind you of the early days of the internet in some of these emerging categories? And what lessons do you think any of these emerging categories that are being built today can learn from wave one of the internet?
Well, each of them a little bit different. I felt 5 years ago there was a little bit too much fluff, maybe a little strong, but kind of confusion about Web3 as a basket of technology. People had a little trouble defining what is a metaverse, is it crypto, other kind of things. That sometimes happens in the early stage of things, and then it kind of sorts itself out. I think with AI, as I mentioned, what's interesting there is it's been developing slowly, quietly, almost transparently for a half a century, but really became much more mainstream in the last couple of years. Kind of had the equivalent of its Netscape moment the internet had that really accelerated people's interest in the internet. That's really now happened in the AI space, even though all of us have been using AI for many years. Many of the apps on our phones that we use every day have been using AI. We didn't know that. Nobody told us that. So that's an example of something. But I think it's also an example, it goes back to this policy point, that even though it's been developing for a long period of time, policymakers weren't paying a lot of attention until a few years ago. And now this country here in Washington, D.C., but also in Brussels and other places, the U.K. is putting in place some kind of rules of the road regarding AI. And suddenly those innovators in the AI space realize they need to spend more time to educate so the policies strike the right balance. You keep the bad things from happening while still enabling the good things to happen. And so that's an example, I think, that was learned from the early days of the internet. We needed to engage in the early days to really get the internet going. And you're starting to see more and more of that in other sectors and new technologies.
I think that's such an interesting tie-in to, this has been on my mind since you said what I thought was fascinating earlier on in the podcast. You said, revolutions sometimes happen in evolutionary ways. That stuck with me. So I have to ask, what's in the name? Why did you decide to name your firm Revolution?
We wanted to think boldly. We wanted to position ourselves in a unique way. We wanted to signal to entrepreneurs that we're willing to kind of join them in swinging for the fences, really trying to take on big industry, big challenges, and really try to be revolutionary. That was a core part of what I want to do when I decided to shift it from just being my own family office to being much more of an investing platform. It is bold. It took us a little while to quietly lock up the revolution.com domain. And we trademarked a bunch of revolution-related brands. We have a group called Revolution Places, for example, doing a lot of things in real estate and hospitality. And so we had to be a little stealthy while we were coming up with the strategy, but we launched the Revolution almost 2 decades ago. And it was really an intent to signal to initially to entrepreneurs and then to LPs who wanted to join us on this journey, that we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to back the next generation of entrepreneurs, not necessarily all in the same places, look for them all around the country. We're willing to take a little bit longer view, recognizing, as you just summarized, that revolutions happen in evolutionary ways. You're willing to recognize there is also policy risk you need to underwrite for, but as I mentioned before, policy opportunity that you can also potentially take advantage of. And so that really was a way for us to signal to the world that we were serious about doing what we could to, quote unquote, change the world in partnership with this next generation of entrepreneurs across many sectors and across many geographies.
That's fascinating. And you mentioned changing the world. Revolutions, we've now seen 3 different waves of either revolutions or evolutions of the internet, as you've so eloquently discussed both here and in your book. What does the 4th wave look like?
Well, Michael, you're going to have to figure that one out. I've given you 3. You have to get another 4. No, I think, in all seriousness, I think each of these waves have ended up being about 20 years. You know, as I mentioned, the first wave was really the 80s and 90s, and then most of the last couple of decades in the second wave. We're now in the relatively early phase of the 3rd wave. So I think we're talking about it for a couple of decades. And just as we saw in these earlier waves, that means multiple technologies. Often those technologies are converging in really interesting ways. And so there's a lot of things that are going to happen that are going to fundamentally transform our lives and create enormous opportunities for the entrepreneurs who are willing to take a shot and the investors who are willing to back them. So I think we're going to be pretty busy. Some of these sectors like healthcare, it's 1/6 of our economy. It's kind of broken. It's pretty inconvenient, pretty expensive. Outcomes aren't all that great. That's going to take some real work over a couple of decades to usher in a new era of health, including a focus more on keeping people healthy, not just sick care, which is what it largely is now. So I think that's really what's going to dominate the 3rd wave. But no doubt there will be a 4th wave and a 5th wave. And I'm sure some of the people listening to your podcast are thinking about what those might be. I just hope I'm alive long enough to see more waves emerge. But we'll stay focused on the 3rd wave for the next at least 10 or 20 years.
Well, we'll be standing on the shoulders of giants to find the 4th and 5th waves. On that point, just quickly, you mentioned, I hope I'll be alive long enough. I guess the thing that comes to my mind is the internet and the innovation actually making these waves of innovation happen faster and the cycles happen faster?
Well, it's a mixed bag. I'd say the innovations are happening faster on the technology side. The pace of innovation is accelerating in areas like AI, for example. But the adoption is generally happening in a slower way because it also requires you to, you know, back to what I said before, you know, find the right partners and engage in the right way on the policy up front, which is why autonomous vehicles, which 10 years ago people thought would be kind of an overnight success, are still slowly emerging. It wasn't the technology that slowed it down. It was getting cities to allow them to, you know, be possible and getting the right partnerships to really allow these things to be commercialized in a significant way. So I think this part of the third wave is going to require a little bit more patience. You are going to see more of those revolutions happening in evolutionary ways. And capital allocators need to understand that and make sure they're being very thoughtful about, you know, timing investments, very thoughtful about reserves, very thoughtful about what the future capital needs are likely going to be. Because the idea you do one round and you're one and done, and the company's going to then go on to be a big success. Those are great when they happen, but they're rare now. I think will be rare in this next wave. A last point I want to end on is just going back to your dad. And sadly, my brother also lost his life for health reasons 20 years ago. My brother Dan was a real innovator. He was the CEO of Hambrick and Quist, one of the pioneering venture firms and also investment banking firms that were taking companies like Apple and Genentech, you know, public in the 80s and 90s, and got struck down. And your dad was such a pioneer in the communications world. I think it should be a reminder to all of us that, you know, we need to play the long game, but we also have to make sure we don't take for granted that we'll be here forever. And that creates a little bit more urgency, I think, for all of us to have the kind of impact, and whether it be in our families, in our communities, in our businesses, in whatever organizations we get involved in, and be optimistic about the future, but don't be presumptuous that you're going to have an unlimited future. I think that was sad to have to go through, I know for you, particularly at a young age, but hopefully it was also a little bit of an inspiration to live a life that is full and to do it with passion and urgency. And you've done that, and I'm super proud of what you've done. I only wish your dad was here to see it.
No, I really appreciate that. And to you and your brother as well, he lived a very full life given what he did. So I think that's a fantastic way to end this. You provided such incredible insights, and you've done such amazing and important work for everything from the internet to the country to what you're doing, your family, everything. So thanks for coming on the show. This was an incredible, incredible conversation.
Thank you, Michael. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Alt Goes Mainstream. I hope you enjoyed it. You can read more about alts at my Substack, altgoesmainstream.substack.com. Thanks a lot, and have a great day. We're going